Hello, good evening, everybody. My name is John Chin. I'm the new interim dean of ARI, the Asian American Research Institute of CUNY. And this is the Friday evening lecture series. So thank you for joining us in person and online for tonight's book talk, The Way You Want to Be Loved, by author and professor Aruni Kashyap, a short story collection telling the stories of queer, displaced lives from India's northeast, an underrepresented region in English fiction. Tonight is actually Aruni's second time presenting here at the Institute. The first was in May 2012 on his book, The Peripheral Imagination, Writing the Invisible India. And the video of that talk is available on our website. So a little bit about Aruni. Aruni Kashyap is Associate Professor of English and Creative Writing and Director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Georgia in Athens, and the 2024-25 Harvard Radcliffe Institute Fellow. He is the author of His Father's Disease Stories and the novel The House with a Thousand Stories. He is also the editor of How to Tell the Story of an Insurgency, 15 Tales from Assam, and the translator of two novels from Assamese to English, published by Zuban Books and Penguin Random House. Aruni Kashyap is the recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, the Faculty Research Grants in the Humanities and Arts Program, the Arts Lab Faculty Fellowship, and the Charles Wallace India Trust Scholarship for Creative Writing to the University of Edinburgh. His poetry and translations have been nominated for various awards. Aruni Kashyap's short stories, poems, and essays have appeared in Catapult, Bitch Media, The Boston Review, Electric Literature, the Oxford Anthology of Writings from Northeast, The Kenyon Review, The New York Times, The Guardian UK, and others. So please welcome Aruni Kashyap.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dr. Chin, for the generous introduction. And thank you very much for organizing this, Anthony, and everybody else who is involved in this institute. And it's really true, and I'm having a very beautiful deja vu, I would say, because 11 years ago I was here. I was a graduate student in Minnesota. I had traveled to New York because my book was to be released 2 months later from Penguin. It was called The House with a Thousand Stories. Am I audible to everyone? Okay. I was invited by this institute to give a talk, and I remember being very stressed because nobody had ever invited me to give a talk like that. And yes, the talk was called Writing the Invisible India, the Peripheral Imagination. And many of the threads and themes that I introduced in the talk about telling stories from marginal regions, telling stories about marginalized people, and telling those stories from the subject position of confidence and by assuming a certain kind of centrality was what was I was trying to convey. I hope over the years I have sharpened my tools of thinking, etc. And different books that you have mentioned, the How to Tell the Story of an Insurgency, 15 Tales from Assam, my second collection of short stories, His Father's Disease, which is debuting in the U.S. as The Way You Want to Be Loved. There are slight differences. I'm going to talk about that. And also my poetry collection, There Is No Good Time for Bad News. All of these actually talk about the conflict between the state and the individual, the tension between the state and the individual, which is very significant in my part of the country where I come from, which is Northeast India, which is Assam. And that's a thread that I have written consistently about, because in 1979, I was much several years before I was born, Assam burst into an insurgency, and there was an armed insurgency, and this armed insurgency has shaped the lives and of people born in the 80s and the 90s and people who still live in Assam in different kinds of ways. But 80s and the 90s are a really horrible time when the insurgency and the consequences of the insurgency affected our lives. And because I was born in the 80s, I think I cannot not think about this fraught relationship the state Assam has with the idea of India, the Ifri relationship, because that defines so much of who we are today. And at the same time, I feel that this ifiness is also a fecund source, a fecund space where I can imagine, where I can step in as a creative writer, as a translator, as an editor, and tell stories of empowerment, and also not necessarily of simply of victimhood and subjugation. Today's talk is not necessarily a lecture, it is actually a book reading, but I'll be talking about the context the context that has shaped this book. The Way You Want to Be Loved actually debuted in India as His Father's Disease. It is a collection of short stories that is set against this insurgency that I speak about, and I'm happy to take questions whenever anybody has. And this insurgency, the long shadow of the insurgency, is something that I'm examining in the collection of short stories. These short stories are written over almost 10 years. Some of the stories are written when I was applying to graduate schools. One of the stories I wrote was used as a writing sample in the graduate school application and became the title story. And then some of the stories are written as part of my thesis workshop, and later also I wrote stories that became part of the collection. But when I started putting together some of the 15 or 20 odd stories I had, the ones that I selected had this common theme. Even though they were located in diverse locales, such as Minnesota, such as Delhi, Assam, Georgia, what really connected all these short stories was that all of these peoples were displaced because of the insurgency. Sometimes they had chosen to displace themselves. Sometimes they had chosen to step out of the country voluntarily because they wanted a better, safer life. Sometimes they had to forcefully get out of the country because of various reasons. But what is also common here is that they were not at ease with the environments that they came from. They eventually also moved to societies such as the United States, which was at dis-ease with these people as immigrants and migrants and so on and so forth. So that's why I thought that His Father's Disease would be a good title. So it was published in India and the UK and Poland. It is forthcoming as His Father's Disease. But between 2019 and 2024, I ended up writing short stories that were sequels to actually the existing short stories in His Father's Disease. Some of the characters, I revisited them because I couldn't get them out of my head. For example, the short story, like The Thread in the Garland here, has a sequel here, which is called Because the Mother-in-Law Was Also a Daughter-in-Law, which is kind of written in written in the style of family soap operas that we see in India, but mocking that narrative style. And there are many other stories where I revisited the characters because I thought I had more things to say. When I found a publisher in the US, my publisher said that The Way You Want to Be Loved would be a good title because it is also a short story, but also it kind of continues to expand on the themes of the conflict between the individual and the state. So what I'm going to do today is read from the first short story, which is called A Skylar Girl. And I think it's a very important and key short story that I'm going to read from the other short story, which is the title short story called The Way You Want to Be Loved. And I'm happy to take questions after that. But before that, some context. The Skylar Girl actually is a retelling of a folktale called Tejimala's Folktale in Assam. And Tejimala is a short story that is a very violent short story told to children. And it is a collection of very pretty, scary, violent short stories that are meant for children. And these are folk tales that have been told over the ages again and again to children. And I also grew up listening. Some elderly person in our family must have told me the story. But also in the early 20th century, one writer called Lakshminath Besbarua, he collected them as grandma's folk tales. And or Buhi Ai Khadhu. But the story called Tejimala, what is this story about? Tejimala is about a girl who is brought up by her stepmother. She loses her mother when she's very young. And the stepmother hates her. And stepmother tries to kill her multiple times, again, again, again. And every time she's violently crushed to death, beaten to death, she comes back to life in various forms until she can reclaim her human form. So it's a redemptive story about a woman, about a girl who refuses to give up on life, who refuses to stop trying to live, who refuses to stop being a consumer of human life. What does it really mean is we can think about endlessly, but definitely it's a very inspiring story despite the sadness and the violence in it. But at the same time, the stepmother figure over the years, as India realized that Assamese people realized that Assam is a very complicated relationship with India, the stepmother figure started to represent the federal structure of India. The stepmother figure started to represent the Delhi government, which is the central government, which doesn't love us enough, you know, who exploits us, who has a very resource extraction relationship with Assam. And as a result of that, many writers in Assam, actually, in Assamese language, and I have to step in here and say that even though I write in English, I'm a bilingual writer. I inhabit both these worlds very comfortably, and I'm very happy that I'm able to do that, which also means that I'm able to tap into these two different language traditions. One language tradition, which is now got a recognition for being a classical language dating back to the 5th century. The other one is the Anglophone tradition, which has resulted as a result of post-colonial epistemic violence in India. What has really, really mean is that people started retelling this story in order to understand this relationship with India. So there are many writers who have written poems, filmmakers have made short films or long-form films, short stories have been written, novels have been written about where Teji Mola has come back and told her story and regained her space in different ways. So people really go back to this story again and again. So I'm not doing something new, as I say, but what I'm doing is I'm probably extending a tradition that already exists, and I'm trying to step in and say something about this relationship. So what am I trying to say is something that I'm going to quickly address and read from the short story. I'm trying to say that when you are stepping into my world of the way you want to be loved, or even House of the Thousand Stories, or the other books that I mentioned, you are actually stepping into a different world. This is not your run-of-the-mill Indian literature. This is Assamese literature. And this is a literature that has emerged because of the tensions that Assam has with India, but at the same time, the friendly relations that Assam has enjoyed with the rest of the subcontinent. But at the same time, this tradition or this body of writing is also deeply shaped by folk imagination, folk tradition. And these are the things that I want to signal very quickly in the beginning of the short story. And you will see that the references are made to marginal literary traditions where there is a conference going on in the title story, Skylark Girl. And the reason I make these references to the marginal literary traditions, because I want to, in many ways, establish my sovereignty, imaginative sovereignty as a writer immediately, long before you get entrenched or immersed into this world. And it's important to me, coming from a space where pro-independence movement has rocked the state for so long. So the idea of sovereignty is very important to me, and I think it's important to all writers and artists, but coming from a space like this, I do not think I can really ignore that question. As a result, I wanted to signal all of this very early on, that you are entering a different space. This is my courtyard, and here are the rules and regulations. In this story, you will see the story of a writer called Sanjib, and he is a writer who writes in Assamese language, and he has been invited to a conference, a literary conference in Delhi. And because it is in Delhi, he cannot read the short story in Assamese, so he is going to read it in English. And while he is preparing for all of these things, there are various kinds of things happening. And this is a new university, and they want to make a mark in the nation by establishing this conference, by organizing these conferences, and so on. And I'm happy to take questions at the end of it. I'll read an excerpt. Skylark Girl. From this distance, the students sounded like birds chirping. They looked carefree, but they had been busy earlier that day, sprinting across the campus for classes and lectures well into the evening. Often their clothes were crumpled, and the men had week-long stubbles. Yet their eyes were still bright, and their young faces glistened. In the evening, a light breeze cooled the campus. Students flocked to the local dhaba or the Chinese takeaway for a quick cup of tea, a snack, late lunch. The trees on the perimeter of the university's 50 acres were no more than 6 feet tall, announcing that they were planted less than a year ago. That the university was new and was trying to make its presence felt through conferences such as the one Sanjeev was here to attend. Last night, when he had arrived, driven by a university-employed driver in a Toyota Innova, it was midnight, but many students were still roaming the grounds. As he took charge of his room at the guest house, Sanjeev missed his undergraduate days. He couldn't believe that was almost 15 years ago. It was around 11 now. He had spent the day attending panels on Indian literature, Dalit literature, literature from Northeast India, and now he was unable to sleep. The well-lit campus provided no privacy, even at night. He found a concrete bench to sit on right under a tall lamp. They run on solar power. The chief organizer of the conference, a middle-aged man in a black kurta, had told him during the Northeast team lunch, Naga and Assamese dishes. Sitting on the concrete bench, Sanjeev read aloud the story he had selected for his session the next afternoon. It felt odd, but he had to read the English translation rather than his own Assamese writing. His English had a thick accent. He halted. How would he tackle the questions from the audience? As an undergraduate, he had studied chemistry, but by the time he took his final year exams, Sanjeev had had enough of the fatty smells in labs. He decided to enroll in a master's program in Assamese literature. It was a new lease on life. He started writing again and gathered a loyal list of readers for the poems and short stories that were published on the department's wall magazine. By the end of his first year, he had not only made it to several mainstream print magazines, but was also elected as the university's magazine editor. It was the most amazing thing that had ever happened to him. But his mother disagreed. She thought this was the most amazing thing to happen to him. This invitation to read at an international conference. For his mother, Delhi was far. Delhi meant the army that committed atrocities on the villages in the 90s. Delhi was for rich people. Its universities were first class. Delhi was the stepmother who treated the people of Assam poorly. That one of those places in Delhi had recognized her son's caliber and invited him to participate in this all-expenses-paid conference was his life's greatest achievement, she felt. To confirm his participation, he had to email them a draft of one of his stories translated into English. He cycled 6 miles in search of a shop with a computer plugged to an internet connection, because even though there were nearly 5 major mobile phone companies competing for attention with free data and unlimited talk time, none of them worked properly in his village. At first, he requested a friend's mother, a professor at the local college, for help with the translation, but she was too scared to agree. She said that after reading Keats and Eliot and Shakespeare for 25 years in Assamese to students of English honors who didn't understand English, she didn't have the confidence to translate his story into English. This was a big thing, a matter of great prestige for the town, so she would connect him with someone at the Cotton College State University who would be happy to translate it. The 4 best stories from the conference would be published in an international anthology, which would be an incentive for this ambitious young colleague of hers. 3 weeks after he received the letter, Sanjeev traveled to Guwahati, 4 hours away, with his mother's blessings. During this trip, he wondered who had nominated him for the conference. He had in mind a few people, possible suspects, but wasn't sure he wanted to think about it. All he had been told was the nomination letters were sought from experts and editors, and that several literary critics had recommended his powerful stories. And now here he was, sitting on a concrete bench at midnight, practicing to read a whole story in a language in which he had never spoken a full sentence. 3 weeks before Tejimala's birth, his mother, Numoli, had eaten so many ripe orange peaches and swallowed so many slippery seeds that she was reminded of her childhood fear. She had strange dreams of becoming a large trunk tamarind, a lanky and weak papaya, a mango tree where ghosts resided. All night, she twitched on her bed. In the morning, when she told her husband, the wandering businessman Dhoniram Haud, he chided her. He said her fears were baseless, but Numoli disagreed. The dreams were from the morning, and she was facing east then, and she had woken up drenched in sweat. She gave him a cup of tea made from the dried bark of a mature orjun tree. Aghuni, the tall and large-eyed midwife who'd help with the delivery in 3 weeks' time, was sitting in the backyard. Later, she told Numoli there was nothing to be afraid of. It wasn't the childhood fear that was haunting her. Her dreams were anticipating the unborn baby, the lush, leafy mango tree she had transformed into in her dreams, standing all alone in a chrome-yellow harvested paddy field, signaled a healthy baby, she said. Never before had Aghuni been wrong in her interpretations of dreams, but this time she was. Numoli died giving birth to Tejimala. While cutting the umbilical cord, Aghuni saw tiny light green buds on Numoli, which confused and scared her so much that she removed them hurriedly. But Numoli was also bleeding and gasping for breath, and Aghuni didn't know what to do to help her. By the time she had bathed the baby, those buds had started to mature into leaves. She plucked them one by one, like plucking fine feathers off the body of a pigeon being prepared for cooking. Soon Numoli's eyelids were covered with parrot green peach trees. Aghuni plucked each one, bud by bud, leaf by leaf. She scrubbed the baby's skin with powdered lentils only after she had removed all the leaves from the mother's body. Aghuni tried hard to make Numoli look like a normal corpse. She informed Dhoniram Khaud about the birth of his daughter. There was no one else in the labor room. That night, Aghuni told Dhoniram Khaud that she would like to stay until the baby girl could take care of herself and was married off to a good boy who would be able to keep her by working in the rice fields or in the newly founded tea gardens of the British, although those were swarming with workers who spoke a strange language from elsewhere. She loved the baby's dead mother like a sister, she said. Aghuni didn't speak to him of her real fears. She was worried that the baby would start sprouting leaves and die like her mother did, though she didn't know how she would prevent it or how she would save the girl. Aghuni wanted to linger. Khaud built her a small hut, but strong hut, in his backyard. Aghuni had no relatives to return to, so she accepted that hut as her own. But she used it only to keep her clothes and belongings and ornaments her mother-in-law had given her on her deathbed. Her days were spent beside the baby's cradle, and later her bed. They had named the baby Tejimala, but everyone affectionately called her Teji. By the time Khaud married a second time, because the village elders pressed him to remarry so that the girl had the mother's caring hands around her, Aghuni had plucked different kinds of leaves off Teji's skin. She used varied paste such as of black-eyed beans or fresh turmeric. She didn't want to repeat her first haphazard, methodless plucking. She thought it was the reason Numoli had died, for which she still blamed herself. As a result of Aghuni's regular ministrations, which she masked as skin care so that the stepmother, Romola, wouldn't know what was going on, Tejimala had the most glowing skin in the whole village. She was dark-skinned, like mature eels and catfishes, and shone even on the moonless nights or at dusk when the day and night met for a wild chat. She also had the most beautiful oval eyes, like slim fishes, with long, thick eyelashes, and only Aghuni worried that they could turn into the vines of a bottle gourd. The worry probably killed her. 2 weeks before, the red-necked leaf-green parrot sang to a middle-aged Khaud who was packing his bags for a trip around the world to sell his wonderful handicrafts and silk clothes, Aghuni passed away in her sleep. The parrot sang, "When you see me, you frown. Into a lady your daughter has grown. When will you get her a groom from the town?" Its shrill voice and accusatory tone reminded Khaud of his second wife, Romola, who was the most quarrelsome woman in the village and treated Tejimala like a slave. He worried that he looked at the bird, sighed, and assured him that as soon as the steamer reached the chest of the Brahmaputra River, he would begin the search for a handsome groom for his only daughter. As was the case whenever Khaud traveled, the night his boat floated towards the Bay of Bengal, Romola cooked delicious dishes for her three sons, but gave Teji only leftover rice with salt, made her sleep on the floor on a bamboo mat, and forced her to do the dishes, wash clothes, and even feed her the cows when they returned home, a man's job. Tejimala was not saddened by this, for she loved the only person she could call Ma. The night cloud left a small green blood, bud sprouted on her finger. She used the sandalwood paste to remove it as soon as she could. Sanjeev had never thought of himself as a handsome man. During those postgraduate days in Guwahati University, it was Riti who made him feel that way. She had accosted him after an open mic on campus and asked if he'd share his mobile number and go out for coffee with her. When he said he didn't like coffee, she called him every day for weeks, inviting him to have tea, thumbs up, Coca-Cola, Citra, cane juice, until he agreed. "Tea," he said, "I'll have tea with you." During what they would later call their first date, he was surprised that someone so attractive and interesting was drawn to him. They dated for 2 years, and everything seemed just right. But he knew he had made a mistake when she took him home for the first time. A huge two-level building in one of the most expensive parts of the city. Their living room had an artificial stream, an aquarium that covered the length of the wall, and the tables had expensive wooden and bronze statues. The marble floor was so clean that he felt his cheap 200 rupee chappals were permanently tainting it. Later he told her, "You know, there is no future to this relationship. Don't you know my father is a farmer? He doesn't even own land. Some years he doesn't get to share crop because the Bangladeshi immigrants do it at a cheaper rates. And your parents own one of the largest construction companies in Northeast India. Must every relationship have a future?" she asked, voice quivering. He paused. They were sitting on a wooden bench in the university campus. It was April. Final exams were at least a month away. She was planning to go abroad for her doctoral studies. Or MPhil. He didn't know. She had never discussed it with him. The Krishnachura tree was in full bloom, its flowers reaching towards the blue spring skies like flames feeding on a large heap of straw. He asked, "What is the point then? I don't want to be anyone's time pass." Later she had texted him. He was never a time pass. What a horrible way to brand a relationship. There was meaning in it. And unlike him, she saw a future for them. He read her text. He thought about the marble floor and his tattered chappals that had been stitched and repaired by the village cobbler. He replied that she was able to see that future because she was on higher ground. He still had a lot to build. A ladder, a staircase, God knows what else, to reach her level. The marble floor and those tattered slippers. Such a mismatch. At the conference luncheon, where the panelists were supposed to meet and bond with the moderator and plan the discussion, he felt like a misfit. The food laid on the table was colorful and looked delicious and fresh with lots of vegetables, but he didn't know what to pick. The labels didn't mean anything to him. Paya, tortillas, fajitas, quesadilla, guacamole. For a second, he wanted to fish out his phone to Google those words, but he was shy. They had said lunch was going to be Mexican, but he was looking forward to it. But he didn't know the names would be in Spanish too. He filled his plate with rice, beans and vegetables, though he knew it was not quite right. Something should be mixed with something, and he was doing it all wrong. Embarrassed, he sat in one corner. The rest of the panelists joined him after reading his name tag. Their hellos were cheerful enough, but he was relieved to meet John, the writer from Nagaland. John knew Nagamese and Sanjeev spoke it fluently. Sanjeev hoped he could be friends with John and hang out around him. For a moment, he forgot his regret at having accepted the invitation. What would happen if his story was accepted in some journal that he had never seen? He didn't know. He was a school teacher who didn't even get his salary regularly. So this is the excerpt from Skylark Girl. And as you can see, the story is sandwiched with the modern day narrative. I'm going to read from the second story and the last story. The Way You Want to Be Loved is actually a novella-length short story. I have a problem. When I start writing, I can go on, and I can never end. I find it easy to write longer narratives. I find it easy to write novels. I think short story is a very difficult art form, and I find it challenging, difficult to actually condense things. But so this one, I had to get out of the world to be able to actually finish the story. Otherwise, this would have been season one, season two, love, more relationships, more complicated. But this is a queer love story between two men, and it starts with a heartbreak. But most important thing about it is that the story is also set against a time when it was illegal just to be gay in India. Until 2018, they repealed the Article 377, which was against homosexuality. This story is also written in second person, which means that I want the reader to be complicit as much as possible in the experience of the characters. In some ways, the narrator here, narrative voice, is saying that to the wider world that we need to take note of this, and hence the you is deliberately used. The way you want to be loved. One, it is almost midnight. You have laid the table with enough food for six people, though there are just two of you. 2 minutes ago, you told the man who is sitting next to you that you love him and you want to spend your life with him. You have known him for 4 years. He is your friend, but you are too close, so close that your friends call you bromosexuals. You already know his answer because he is staring at the steamed white rice on his plate. For 2 whole minutes, he holds a piece of carrot and stares at his rice. He doesn't touch the cauliflower that has been sauteed with mango powder and cumin, his favorite. Your world is coming to an end. You don't handle the situation well. If you don't handle the situation well, you'll never be able to face him again. So you keep quiet. It is so hard to breathe. He is the first one to speak. Utpal, this is awkward. You are whispering, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. No, don't be. I knew. I had been wondering. See, you are one of my closest friends, and we have been friends for 4 years, Rudra says. But I can't love you the way you want me to love. It is not possible. The two of you are having dinner at your apartment. You have cooked his favorite chicken curry. This is a red candle. There is a red candle on the table, and in the corner of the room, a stone aroma dispenser. A tea light heats up the lavender oil and water in a little bowl. I understand, you say, but your gut is about to come pouring out. I needed to tell you that I have feelings for you. I needed to be honest with you. I'm so sorry. That is true. You want to be honest with him. You need to tell him before the untold stories churn your stomach, demolishing its walls. But you had also thought he would feel the same way because he cuddles with you and watches movies with you under the same blanket. Every weekend, when he comes to spend time with you, he leaves after planting a kiss on your cheek. For about 3.5 years, these signs of affection didn't bother you. But you don't know what happened around 3 months ago. You woke up one day and realized Rudra is the man you want to spend your life with. You needed to tell him that. Be honest with him. Give it a shot. Please don't be sorry, Rudra says. He doesn't finish his dinner, leaves early. He tries to hang around, but as he said, everything is awkward now. You're burning with guilt. Once he leaves, you throw away the food, the cauliflower, chicken curry, split pigeon peas, potato and carrot fry, cucumber tomato salad in unprocessed mustard oil. You spend 6 hours cooking this. You press your face into your pillow and cry, trying hard not to make sounds. You live alone. You don't know why you want to cry silently. After the heartbreak, you join dating apps so that you can sleep around and forget him. You are angry with Rudra, and since you can't say hurtful things to him, you distribute yourself in the arms of nameless men. After sex, the bed is cold as night stones. You find yourself in unknown homes in random corners of the city. In the morning, if you're lucky, you can hear the din of trucks and other large automobiles carrying perishable and non-perishable goods outside. Otherwise, a heavy silence broken only by the sound of ceiling fans nearly chokes you. If you are lucky, your date is still sleeping and you can pad out quietly like a cat because you know you will never meet him again. If you are lucky, you won't end up bawling in the cab back home or on the metro in the metro rail, feeling guilty for sprinkling parts of yourself across this city that rarely gives back. This is a brutal city. There are brutal people here. You want to get out of here, but you find yourself in the same restaurants, the same neighborhoods, under the shadow of Gulmohar and people and Banyan and Neem. It has been 2 months since you told Rudra that you don't want to talk to him. It has been 2 months since Rudra said to you that he doesn't accept your decision to not speak to him because you fell in love with him and you jeopardized their friendship. He's not ready to lose a friend. He calls you every week, and because you can't resist, you receive the calls. You don't see how he's wrong. You are in love. He's right. It is your fault. You feel so lost so often that you find corners in your office to shed tears. You can't bawl in your office. You continue to talk to Rudra, but only when he calls. Yet, there are some days when you call him because you just want to hear his voice. Once, you hear the voice of another man in the background. Rudra always receives your calls, even in the middle of the night. 2 months ago, you were the best of friends. Who is that, Rudra? You ask in a quivering voice. He pauses. Then he says, I know this is going to hurt you. I thought I brought someone, but you know, you should know the truth. You deserve to know the truth. Okay, you say. Rudra is silent. Okay, I'll call later. You hang up and rush to the sink to throw up. It has been 2 months, and you feel like a malnourished, yellowed patch of grass under a brick. You stop calling him not because you dislike him, but because you don't want to throw up or spend any more nights sleepless. After a point, you start keeping to yourself. You go to work, edit copies on your desk. You edit good news and bad news, celebrity gossip and classified pages. Your silence is frightening. Your colleagues want to talk to you, but they notice your red eyes, your dark circles, your stern face, the melancholy look, the stay the hell away from me look. One of your colleagues who care about you, who is almost a friend but not a friend, calls Tara, your closest friend who lives in South Delhi. Tara saves you from this mess. She always saves people from messes. Actually, it is her profession, like literally. For the last 2 months, she has been busy with her new NGO that works for queer rights. She also heads a small legal team that fights for LGBTQ+ rights in Delhi. They have filed a case against a colonial law that criminalizes gay sex. Gay men, lesbian women, trans people all over Delhi know her phone number. When women contact her complaining about their families forcibly trying to marry them away, she calls important people in those cities. Those important people send the police to save those women and bring them to Delhi. And Tara ensures they find shelter in the Kasturba Gandhi Memorial State House for homeless women. When Delhi police arrest men for holding hands in public, when they beat up men for kissing in public, when dirty cops arrest helpless men because they want to have some quick fun on the job, if you don't have sex with us, we'll arrest you under Section 377. They call Tara's number for SOS help. Tara's phone is never silent. Tara and her work partner, who are both co-founders of the organization, are lawyers. They're always speaking about article this and section that. You have heard that Tara is especially gutsy, that one must see her at the police station. You wonder if you ever want to see that side of her. You admire her immensely. At first, Tara texts you. When you don't answer her text for a week, she comes to meet you at the office. She brings homemade food and always turns up at lunchtime. One day she drives you to your apartment and tells you that she is here to take you to her house, where she is organizing a big party the next day. Only handsome single men will be invited. You will pick one of them, but you will not attend any crazy parties to get drunk. You sit on the sofa and stare at her as if she is talking about UFOs. There is a yellow light with a bamboo lampshade hanging from the ceiling. The bookshelf on your left is full of novels that you have grown up reading and loving. The 42-inch television is playing on low volume because you fell asleep on the couch while watching. You shouldn't have slept on the couch. Your neck hurts and you still feel sleepy. It is early morning. She has brought your favorite South Indian coffee. She pours you a cup from the drip. There is freshly squeezed orange juice and poached eggs on the table. The ceramics collide against each other and the sound is music to your ears. You realize it is not the ceramic, the smell of coffee, or the orange hue of the juice, but it is Tara. Her reassuring presence. Also, the sound tells you that there is music in everything. You just have to know how to listen. For the last 2 weeks, every morning, you have woken up and eaten yogurt with frozen fruit or bacon, or put cheese on a slice of bread to grill in the microwave. Now, the fresh peaches feel lovely in your mouth. Thank you, you say. Come with me. Please come with me. For how long are you going to mourn this? You are silent. All right. Mourn, but at my place, you play with my dog, my cats. You have a job to handle. You have a life ahead of you. You are the only son of a single mother. Your heart is aching and you laugh with her. You are a patch of green grass under a heavy brick, but Tara lifts it. you don't even know when you agree, when you pack bags, when you are on the road from one end of the city to another, you realize that you have accepted Tara's offer only when you register that you are stuck in a massive traffic jam. How long have you been here? You look around and see that you are under a flyover. You are somewhere in central Delhi. On both sides of the road, fruit and juice vendors are trying to attract customers. The fruits are so colorful. You see that a tandoori chicken vendor has dressed a whole chicken in the red tandoori spice paste and hung it upside down. A man next to him fries egg rolls. The air is so polluted and dusty that you can see it moving. Almost everyone is roaming around with surgical masks. There's a large advertisement of a mask ahead of you on the left side of the road. It claims to have two layers that filters every small particle. There are no insects. They're all dead because of the pollution. At least that is a good thing, you think. We're all slowly dying. What? Yes, very slow, half an hour tops. Don't worry, we'll be home soon. She looks straight ahead as the car moves in. If you need to sleep, just doze off. You want to sleep, but you want to talk to her so that she doesn't feel bored. It'll take another 2.5 hours to get to her place in this traffic. Without traffic, 1 hour and 40 minutes. No, I'm sorry, I have been quiet. How are things with you? The usual, hey, sister fucker. She rolls the window down and shouts at a guy who cuts past her. It's a very common abuse in Delhi. Everyone says it. Everyone, men, women, everyone. I'm going to end with something happy. I think I'm going to read from this story called The Americans. It is a story about a young undergraduate immigrant student who comes from from India to the U.S. And, you know, he faces strange circumstances. He has a roommate who is strange. And it is also written in second person. The Americans. At the International Students Orientation, the staff teaches you how to say sorry and thank you. They say when someone says they are sick, you should say, I'm sorry. The students you sit next to are North Indian. They are the kind of loud and patriotic North Indians you normally wouldn't be caught dead with. You are ashamed that you are laughing with them. What other funny things these Americans are going to teach us? The handsome Punjabi guy with a beard asks you before switching to Hindi. And you like the way he pronounces Americans. Hindi is not your language, but you don't mind that he assumes you speak and understand it because you are from India. You laugh with the Punjabi guy. A few days later, you are surprised that you are drawn to the Bangladeshi students. The Bangladeshis whom you grew up slightly hating for migrating in thousands to your already overpopulated state. You talk about rice and fish curry and Durga Puja and Bhupen Hazarika's songs and feel guilty. You hang out with Shahid, the student from Dhaka, who challenges you to eat a burger without making a mess on your plate. He borrows his friend's car and drives you to Minneapolis, where both of you eat at a restaurant called The Taste of India, run by Punjabi-speaking Pakistanis. Garlic, naan and butter chicken, gulab jamuns for dessert. You both almost weep with joy. When you offer him money for gas, he scolds you. Don't be so money-minded like the Americans. A month later, Shubham, the Punjabi guy, and Shahid, the Bangladeshi guy, are your closest friends. When you fall sick in October, they turn up at your apartment instead of sending texts such as XOXO, get well soon, and I'm sorry you are sick. They make you spicy soup, sleep on your couches, and make lists of girls they want to fuck. A week later, you don't tell your mother about those lists, your bad health, the winter that is coming too soon. Instead, you tell her there are two seasons in Minnesota, winter, and preparing to fight through winter. She laughs. You think about how she was silent at the eye hospital when you pressed her hand. You are suddenly surprised that she understood your touch. You wonder if she cried as soon as you turned to X-ray your duffel bag at the airport. You hide in the bathroom and cry. You don't tell Shahid. You don't tell Shubham. But they look at your reddish eyes, slap your back, and buy you a beer. They don't leave you alone because you're sad. They force their presence on you, and you like that. And you joke that the Americans would never do something like that because they're very respectful of your personal space. Mike, your roommate, has an Indian girlfriend called Neelakshi. She often spends the night in your flat, mostly during weekends. He tells you that this year has been amazing for him since he has never shared an apartment with a non-white person before. And now he is thrilled to have more international experience with an Indian girlfriend who he started dating 3 months before you arrived. With your permission, Mike changes the apartment's Wi-Fi username to Diverse Club. You are amused and annoyed. He asks you questions that you don't like. He asks you whether your hair grows straight up like African Americans or whether you straighten your hair. He is astonished that you can speak English so well. Since he's an English major at the university, he corrects you fortnightly to every 2 weeks. And you're out of station to out of town and is completely horrified when you use the word preponed. You say it is Indian English. He says, does it even exist? He tells you about the new Pakistani student in his class who doesn't wear a skull cap and expects you to be surprised. He is surprised that you are not surprised. Mike changes the Wi-Fi username to South Asian Station because he thinks it is more apt. You pretend to find it funny, but you think that he can be insufferable. In December, when his grandmother visits, she asks if you are Muslim. She's happy to know that you aren't Muslim. She gives you a piece of lemon cake and confides in you that she worries Muslims are going to take over America soon. You nod. You don't get annoyed. But you are annoyed when everyone wishes you Merry Christmas on the last working day before Christmas. You rant about it to Shubham and Shahid. It doesn't bother them. Neelakshi moves into the apartment. The good thing is that the three of you now split the rent and power bills. The bad thing is that the frequency of the noisy sex increases to at least 4 times a week. You're woken up by their moans and gasps, the sound of their bodies slapping, the creaking bed, a lot of yes, 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 and you like it right. You are not sure how to broach the matter. You decide you hate American houses. You complain that there is no privacy. Shubham and Shahid find the situation hilarious and ask if the lovemaking gives you a hard-on. One morning, you find Mike sleeping on the couch on top of Neelakshi without his boxers. Later, Shubham says you should have drawn a smiley face on his bum with a black permanent marker. When you call your mother, you don't tell her that you are annoyed with your roommate. You tell her that Mike is good and takes care of you. You make her talk to Shubham and Shahid. She speaks to them in broken Hindi and fluent Bengali. You proudly say that a lot of people from Assam know Bengali, something you would never admit to in India, even though it is a fact. In April, your mother falls sick. She has hypertension, and your father rushes her to the hospital. She is moved to the intensive care unit. Her blood pressure is unstable for 12 hours. The doctor spears a gelatin pill and places it under her tongue every 3 hours. You spend a lot of time on the phone with your father. You feel guilty that he has to manage alone. You are their only son. You look at flights online, though you know you can't afford them. Your father asks you not to come home because he knows you can't afford the cost of a flight. After the medical bills, he cannot either. The pilot helps your father, the pilot as in the driver, because he likes being called pilot. His wife cooks meals for your presence. He stays in the hospital day and night so that your father can use the car when he needs it. You are the first person your mother wants to talk to when she is out of the ICU. I won't die without seeing you. She chuckles. Your grandmother tells you not to worry, to eat well, and return to India as the same healthy boy we brought up. You smile. You wonder if her eyes are welling up like yours. You remain sad for a long time. You share your anxieties with Neelakshi and Mike and Shahid and Shubham. Mike asks if the driver will charge you your parents overtime, and you want to slap him hard. You snap. It's called goodwill. Everything is not about money like here in America. You are exploiting the driver. You should pay him overtime, Mike says hotly. Neelakshi does a bit of contextualizing. Why must every act of kindness be returned with money? You can return it with kindness. Mike is not pleased. He says he doesn't get South Asian culture. Neelakshi says something funny. She has quite a risible American accent. She throws her R's and rolls her tongue a lot. The rumor among the Indian community in the university is that Neelakshi is seducing Mike because she wants a passport. Back in India, your mother is brought home. People do such horrible things. She complains to you on the phone. Your brother-in-law says that he knows an old couple who live near the airport. They have 4 children, and all of them have moved to the U.S. When the man died, there was no one to cremate him. You sense your anger rising quickly. Well, Ma, if educated people don't know what to do when a person dies, who does? Don't become like them, like other Indians, when they go to America. Please come home when you can. We'll arrange the money, okay? You laugh, but you know that her mother is expressing her deepest fears. In May, Mike sends you an email in bullet points. When a Minnesotan person sends an email in bullet points, you should know that they are very mad at you. Your friend Amy tells you, and she laughs so much that she almost chokes on her bottle of sparkling water. You decide not to write back, but talk. At the apartment, Mike looks through you. When you say, "We need to talk," you feel as if you are his boyfriend broaching a breakup. He turns around and says in a calm voice that he would prefer to be emailed. You say that you would prefer to talk because you have no time to respond to his slanderous allegations by email. You have papers to write. Nilakshi assumes the role of the mediator to save the situation from becoming worse. You debate with her in Hindi and English. Your voice rises many times as Mike hovers. You tell Nilakshi that it is not possible for you to spray antibacterial chemicals every time you use the kitchen, and that you will get your own dishes because Mike uses most of the dishes and expects Nilakshi and you to wash them. Thank you. Thank you so much for patiently listening to my stories.
Yeah, Desi Mama's story kept me up at night when I was 5 years old. And it was cool, yet it was like empowering as well.
Mm-hmm. Redemptive.
Redemptive, that's the right word.
Yeah.
But the context was, you said you were trying to compare the character with, are you trying to portray her as a Sam or a Sunnis?
I think it's not me who tried it. There's a whole tradition of Teji Mulla's stories being told and retold, and the contextualization and the interpretation are not necessarily done by children, but they are done by adults, and they often use India is treating us like Teji Mulla. India is treating us like Teji Mulla's stepmother. That is the narrative that, you know, the most of the pro-independent, also nationalist, also pro-regional narratives use constantly. You know, Mahi Aaye, they keep on using the word which means stepmother. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that most folk tales are pretty violent because it is preparing us for a violent world that we will grow up and notice. In many ways, I think people who read fiction from a very young age, both folk tale as well as realist fiction or fantasy, where horrible things happen, they become emotionally matured at a much faster way, actually. Yeah. Even though it is very jarring and very disturbing, and I feel that folk tales, which is the knowledge of the ancestors, of traditional knowledge, is in many ways telling us that we need to prepare the children for a violent world that is unequal, unjust, violent, constantly going to gaslight you, attack you, or cause you harm. So how do you become resilient emotionally by actually listening to these kind of redemptive but violent stories?
Yeah, it reminded me of like Cinderella's story, right?
Yeah.
And but we don't see the comparison between state and, you are calling it central government. That's the federal
mm-hmm.
government, right? State
yeah.
and federal government. That's the shadow behind the story.
Yes, yes. Yes.
That's why I wanted to know the annual, but I'm fine. you have a lot of magic. I mean, Assam is full of magic.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of voodoo and all that, right? And a lot of your stories has some magical, I wouldn't say magical realism, but a lot of magic in it. How do you write, when you write in Assamese, the same connotation of magic from Assamese point of view you're bringing to English? Is it, how hard it is or how easy it is for you to do?
First of all, writing is very easy for me. Mm-hmm. That's the easiest thing I do. My hardest thing for me is to find time to write it, actually. So I'm very grateful it is easy for me. So, but stylistically speaking, when I write in English, the structure and the tone and the language that I actually that have helped me are indigenous writers such as Louise Erdrich, for example, in America. One of the writers who really helped me find language and help me basically stylistically was Marquez, who constantly uses folk tales a lot in his own work. In Assamese, I wouldn't actually I write without any worry, because in Assamese I would never get a question like this, for example, right? Because it is so much in the collective imagination. I come from a village called Mayong, where my family is from. So as a result, and which is this is a cluster of four or five large villages where basically practitioners of Tantra live. My grandmother was a tantric. My father's elder brother was a tantric. My grandmother is from Mayong. So writing a story that might come across as a magic realist story for the Western reader is not a difficult thing to write in the Assamese language at all, because those stories, they already exist in the public imagination. Yeah, thank you. Great questions. Okay, Abhinav, and then Kaveri, I do. No.
Kind of following up on that, like I see that a lot of the names you use are very Assamese as well, and also some of the context. How do you make sure like the universality of it, and like how has like an audience I don't think you write for a specific audience, but how has like the Western audience received without knowing the context of?
Yeah, actually the Western audience, I would say, let's say American audience, the regular public is far more smarter than what the publishing industry would like us to believe, actually. Otherwise, a book like God of Small Things would not have been popular, you know, where there are all these complicated relationships, or a book like The Shadow Lines, where there are Bengali relationships being constantly referred to, Thamma, you know, Dad Dida, and all of that. So I think these two writers, just to speak of, there are many more writers, have already created an atmosphere where I don't have to worry about. I can already step into an already existing discourse and a conversation. So that's one thing. The other thing is that regarding the audience thing, I think the universality of the story, this is something that I always tackle in my classes, because my graduate students, my undergraduate students who are doing undergraduate studies in creative writing or PhD in creative writing, they're constantly interested in knowing how do you write universal stories. And actually, look at Faulkner. All his stories are set in Mississippi. That to an imagined village called Yoknapatawpha, right? And very, very specific to Mississippi. But he's read from Jorhat to, you know, to Delhi, to Lagos, to Mombasa, you know, anywhere. Right, so Faulkner is a great example. There are many more examples I can provide, you know, or Toni Morrison, for example, which is so much rooted in the American Black experience, African American experience, so rooted, and she was never concerned whether people would understand her work, because it is in the particular and the specifics actually the universal exists. If a writer constantly tries to make it universal, we will be writing formulaic stuff like Hollywood. You'll see the Hollywood stories, they follow a formula, right? And repeat it. That is repeated because that what is a safe thing to do, you know? Or if you just watch five episodes from Shonda Rhimes shows, you'll know there's a formula, you know? They're very entertaining. It works. She keeps on repeating it. But what it makes reduces art and reality to a certain set formula. And that is not intellectually exciting anymore. One can do that. If I'm writing thrillers, I would always formulate a formula because I wanted to sell 1 million copies. But when I'm writing artistically challenging, aesthetically challenging work, I don't want to do that. I want to bring in my experience, my aesthetics, my politics while doing that. So this is a work that I want to do that here. But when I probably write a thriller, I would look at all the work formulas that has worked, and I will write a thriller one day.
So I had a privilege to visit Assam a few times, and years ago, a lot of people were speaking in Assamese. But when I got back last time, it was maybe 9 years ago, so our cousins, children, they're now going to all English speaking. And I just want to know what you think about those younger generations. Of course, it's easier because a lot of Indian students come here. Very easy to get, you know, acculturated and get in. But when, for example, Ireland, they started bringing back Gaelic to school system. What do you think? I really like the way you introduced this. You're a bilingual writer. And a lot of people who have never visited or who have never studied about India, they don't understand there's so many different, not only states and prefecture, what do you call it? There's a language, different languages, different religions. And I was just very, very, you know, saddened by the fact that local people are not able to speak yet in Assamese in the school system. Because younger parents choose English speaking school. So what do you think about as a writer of both languages?
Yeah, great question. Thank you very much. I think, first of all, the question about whether our language is dying is a very relevant question because of colonialism, because of the power of English, the unequal power of English, and how the language of commerce, internet is English. We are forced to read in English. The biggest companies, Hollywood is in English, so on. So it does exert a lot of pressure and influence in eclipsing languages. But at the same time, I think, at least in Assam's case, this worry about the language is dying is very much like a worry that the novel is going to be dead. It comes up every few years, but the novel has survived a pandemic most recently when I checked. In the same way, as a bilingual writer, from 2001 to 2013, I consistently wrote in Assamese. I wrote a column in Assamese for a whole year for Amar Ahom. I wrote short stories, numerous of them, essays, literary criticism in Assamese. I debuted as an Assamese writer and continue to write consistently, not without any break, for 13 years before my first novel was published in 2013 in English. I wrote in English, but nobody was publishing me. That's where the problem. But Assamese writers, publishers were publishing me. And I continue to publish in Assamese. I have written 3 novellas and a novel in Assamese, and I write regularly articles and essays and short stories whenever possible in Assamese. With that knowledge in mind, with that insider's knowledge, I can tell you that actually there's a huge readership of Assamese literature, and books do sell. One of my dear friend, Rubul Maut, his book is the highest-selling memoir in Assamese language. It's called Muruvata Hopuna, So Even I Have a Dream, kind of echoing on Dr. King's words. It's a story of it is his autobiography. He works at Harvard right now, but he grew up in rural Tinsukia, in Kakapothar, actually. And he writes about his journey from Kakapothar to Harvard in the memoir. It's a very inspiring journey. It continues to sell. People are gifting that book, reading that book. There are blogs about that book. There is a movie now, a series or movie being made. And that's not just one book, I'm telling you. There are numerous books like that. Makam, for example, by Rita Chaudhary, was one of the highest-selling novels in the history of Assamese literature. Why do we not know about it when we go to Guwahati? Because people in Guwahati don't read Assamese, simply because of that. You know, people in Guwahati live in, they would express these anxieties, but they wouldn't buy an Assamese book and go and support an Assamese author. You know, even in Assam, even now, people say, give me a copy of your book, but they would never buy it. As a principal, I never actually gift copies of my book. I gift other books to my friends, but I don't gift copies of my book because I think authors should be supported if you really care about language and so on and so forth. But people in Assam don't, in Guwahati, don't buy books. But because I have straddled these two worlds, and right now I live in a village, I have seen people who live in thatch house with straw roof, they will save 200 rupees, go to the local book fair, and buy 4 books. This is one of the reasons why a very well-known author, one of the highest-selling authors I know, who I'm a translator of, her name is Anuradha Horma Pujari. She told me that she always tells her publishers to keep the books low, the price of her books low, because she knows someone sitting in rural Assam will take the public transport and not take a cab or, you know, or a more expensive form of transport to go and buy four books by just taking 200 rupees in her hand. But a person living in Guwahati or big city would go to cafe coffee there and spend 500 rupees and say books are so expensive, we don't want to buy them. You know, that is a huge class disparity I see in actually an approach towards literature. And so that is the reason. I think it's a very urban and very limited anxiety that urban Assamese people have.
First of all, thanks for the reading.
Thank you.
Pointing out the complexity as well. However, while like you were reading, I was also struck by how it was sounding like a sort of like documentation as well to me, a kind of remembering perhaps. I was just curious about the role of memory perhaps in your fiction writing. And second is, I must admit it was a little harsh on my ears to hearing about like Romola's character.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just have so many of these, I mean, so, you know, so much has been sort of, now we are sort of aware of, you know, the sort of stereotypes,
mm-hmm.
you know, stepmothers get tagged with it. So was it difficult for you writing that character?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, regarding memory, I don't know how to approach that, but I think, you know, memory and autobiography and experience and imagination, where I don't have memories, they all mix together they're all tossed around when I'm writing. So, in many ways, I'm playing the role of an archiver as well. You know, I'm trying to be a good ancestor by telling and archiving these stories so that the next generation reads it and knows what not to do, what to be careful about. So I think that's the role of any storyteller. I think all of these things do play in. Memory is a very significant part. And I think memory, things that are in our memory, we don't really value it, but I think when you write it, we know how valuable it is. So in a way, I'm transmuting probably memory into writing in order to give it more value and say that this is also history that is important. I'm sorry, what was your second question? I love two-part questions, that's why. Stepmom. Yeah. You know, yeah, it's a stereotype that stepmoms are all terrible and so on and so forth, and because of Bollywood has not helped, all the Lalita power characters, you know, it doesn't help. I think stepmoms are vilified for no reason. But when I'm writing this, I'm tapping into a tradition of a folk tale where I cannot really change the fundamentals, because that would be that would not be loyal to the indigenous tradition that I'm drawing from. Because indigenous people get misrepresented all the time. I don't want to misrepresent by giving a positive stepmother and creating a different villain. But I think if I'm writing a realist story, I wouldn't think of a stepmother in these ways. But most of the conflict comes into Tejumala's story from the stepmother. And so it was not difficult for me in terms of like, but I'm aware what it is tapping into and feeding into. But at the same time, I cannot create the conflict and the tensions and problems in my life unless I bring in Romola. Romola is actually my creation. In this folktale, there is no name. She's just a vague smokescreen figurehead, you know, like who is just terrible and horrible and defies all expectations of motherhood, basically, you know. And she hates Tejumala with so much ferocity. And she loves her children, biological children, with so much ferocity. So, but this is how folk tales are, very black and white and very extreme, right? Yeah.
So, I also have a question about the use of the setting person.
Mm-hmm.
And my little experience in like writing classes here, like it's a risky choice.
Yes.
To me. And I want to hear a bit more about like why this choice and why in these stories, like just a bit more of the background.
Yeah. In the American story, I wanted to challenge myself, truly, you know. But at the same time, when I was writing it in first person, I didn't enjoy it. But when I wrote it in second person, I enjoyed it so much more than I would write have written in another person. So it is simply an exercise. Many of the stories are even I write are simply because I want to challenge myself in a new technique of writing. But when I was writing The Way You Want to Be Loved, I really wanted it to be in third person for various reasons. One of the reasons is that I wanted the story to pull in anybody who is reading it into the world of the story by addressing them, you, as in not just the people who are sympathetic to these characters, but people who probably would be violent to these characters also should be drawn in. Because it is through these stories and through their experience, I can actually say, look what you have done, you know, and how can you be a good ally to the community. Those are the messages I wanted to send across. So hence picking the second person was very crucial for me, because I wanted to remind that in the unequal, unjust treatment of these characters and the wider community they come from, everyone is complicit, and that's why the you, that it's an address to the wider community. It's because first person or the third person, probably I wouldn't be able to do that. Also, the other thing is that first person narratives are most common, right? Coming of age novels, one of the most common narrative forms. Third person narratives are the second most common narrative forms. So when you are reading a story that is from a first person or a third person, you are not jarring it. You have to adjust into the narrative voice of you in order to actually get into that world. You know, it's not easy because you don't read second person stories that often. And I want the reader to go through that discomfort. If these characters are going through such harrowing discomfort, as you will see later, because of the laws, because of the patriarchy, because of homophobia, I think it's a little price to pay for a reader who is coming from possibly a space of slightly more privilege, because the majority of the world is heterosexual or heterosexist. So it's a little price to ask from the reader. But in general, also, I think somebody who is a natural ally of these people or belong to the community, they probably will feel it more in their heart, you know. In so many ways, stories that raise questions about human rights and justice is about stirring the emotions of the reader so that people can be moved into taking actions or thinking into taking action, you know. Anthony?
Let me get these two online questions.
Oh, okay, great, yes.
Rima online said, lovely stories. It seems that the collection politicizes desire. Can you speak a little bit about your aesthetic decisions in writing politicized desire or the range of high-stakes desire?
Okay. I think desire is something that our society, especially Indian society, is very uncomfortable with. And not just like homosexual desire, but I think heterosexual desire too, female desire, female sexuality. We have seen numerous stories, novels in Indian literature, Indian Bollywood movies, where women are punished by the narrative for just being themselves, for assuming their desire, or going after things they desire. It could be even like eating a fruit to having sex with somebody. So I think desire is deeply political, and exercise of desire is deeply political in our society. So what I'm doing is merely borrowing from, merely representing it actually as truthfully as I can, in order to make people think about it, hopefully. That is what I'm trying to do. I wouldn't politicize this unless there are laws suppressing desire. These laws exist for a very long time and has punished many of my friends in very brutal ways. It is already a very political issue. There was a Marriage Equality Act that was, attempt in India, but it didn't go through. And it's really important for, I think, queer people to be able to marry because of various reasons. We can have a whole conference about that. Yeah.
And then the next question is actually from our good friend Russell Young.
Hey, Russell. Hello, Russell.
He's watching online. So he asks, as an Asian writer or writer of color, how do we keep our work from being read as ethnographic?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think we can... We are always asked ethnographic, anthropological questions also quite a lot when I go to many conferences. I think one of the ways of doing it is to refocus the conversation to aesthetics and craft. For example, I did not talk about much about the sociology of desire, but I talked about third person, second person, first person. That's craft. That's a question that I want to be asked, because that's where I come in. I don't go into the field like an ethnographer or an anthropologist to do research. I use my lived experience. I speak to people, and then I let my imagination step in to do the work. Because I'm able to imagine, that is why I'm a fiction writer, you know. So I think that we have to continually refocus and rearrange the conversation into aesthetics and craft again, 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 so that we are seen as artists always.
So you are speaking about this idea of, like, you know, Assamese as a language or in its survival, right? And
that was a question I got, yeah.
That was a question that was being posed. Is it like, and the issue of, like, you know, buying books also, like, and how Guwahati has become this sort of English-speaking, like, sort of island in the middle of Assam, like, you know. Spoke about, like, buying of books, like, you know, and the commercial value of books sort of depleting, but that's a thing that is in a question about Guwahati, let's say. But at the same time, would you say the anxiety of the survivability of Assamese as a language, also anxiety that's contained to, do you think, Guwahati, or do you think that is felt across the state, like, you know, in other places? Like, because, I mean, the whole thing about it's always also always, like, you know, posing the question of the immigration and other political things, right? So I'm just curious to know, like, if it's a very urban thing or it's an upper class thing. Yeah.
Actually, I was about to just say that. I think it's a very UC anxiety about, you know, it's a valid anxiety in every Indian language. As I said, there's a bigger context to it about English or colonialism, consequences of colonialism, language of the internet, and so on and so forth. It's a very valid anxiety. It is English is eating up and eclipsing major language systems, and that's a real problem. It already eclipsed numerous indigenous languages in this country, for example. So the anxiety exists because of that. But also, I think on the ground, I don't meet many English-speaking people when I go to Assam, you know. But if my life revolves between Uzan Bazaar and Juru Tinali, then I would only meet English people. If I go to India Club for drinks and homeroom and Pan Bazaar, probably I'll meet a lot of English-speaking people. If I live a lot in Jalukbari, where the Guwahati University is, maybe I'll meet a lot of, you know. It's so class oriented, and I grew up in that space. I lived in the heart of Guwahati. Everybody I know was very cosmopolitan because my father worked in All India Radio Guwahati, and so I grew up in the All India Radio campus where everybody was from all over the country. We spoke in English and Hindi and Assamese and Bengali. Growing up, neighbors were it is a multilingual small community. So I thought, well, that is how the world is probably, you know. But because as a writer who writes in Assamese, I go to a lot of book conferences which are not covered by the media, you know, or literary festivals which are not covered by the media. And I see that there's a huge interest. In fact, the anxiety among Assamese middle class and upper class people is ironical, because it is actually the immigrants from erstwhile East Bengal or current Bangladesh. They actually write and read in the language, sustain the language in the community, you know. They are the largest speakers, largest users of the language, and the middle class Assamese xenophobia and Assamese nationalism has really alienated and marginalized them, actually. So it's a terrible thing.
You said there's a formula for writing thrillers and so on and so forth. So what's your formula for balancing identity, culture, and
Oh, I don't think there is a formula for that, but I think it's very important for me to write from the space of who I am, by assuming the centrality of who I am, you know, there are many labels, and I'm okay and comfortable with those, because the world sees us in so many different ways. I reject sometimes some of those labels come with pity, you know, or condescension. Those are the ones I don't care about. But the feelings I don't care about. But the labels are, I think, in many ways empowering. I think it is so empowering to be a Assamese writer. I think it's so empowering to be a writer of color, because I can look at the world differently than the white world. You know, it is so empowering. It is so lush. It is so much more full of possibilities. So I embrace those labels, actually. So I don't think there can be any formula. I think we have to be true to ourselves. That's the formula, probably, so to speak. Yeah. But thrillers have very set formulas. They're online. You can Google them.
this really wonderful, thought-provoking, moving, funny reading. Really appreciate it. I think you're selling books tonight as well. So you can purchase the books tonight. And you can also purchase the book online from Singapore Unbound, especially for those who are watching online. The link is available on the webpage for tonight. So thank you so much for being with us here tonight. Thank you, Aruni, again.
Thank you
so much.